Won't be long and spring will find us, month number two nearly behind us, waiting for March to come in and go out, like a lamb, 'cause we've earned it, I have no doubt. Welcome to Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. The arts, culture, and humanities of Western Wisconsin, right here. What a cast we have this week. We're fortunate to be speaking with another of the new generation of novelists, Brandon Taylor, who, like Britt Bennett, featured a couple weeks ago, will be a guest of the Chippewa Valley Book Festival. And while we're on the topic of wordsmiths, Michael Perry is helping raise some money for a conservancy in southern Wisconsin tonight, Thursday. And it gave us the opportunity to check up on his activity. Then, and it must be the season of raising money as well as raising temperatures, Fierce Freedom, the entity that focuses on our awareness of the human trafficking dilemma, not only in America but our backyard as well, well, they're having a night of freedom and hope next week, and our guests will deliver details on how to participate. But first up on our final February fair is this. One of the many successful and anticipated ways we've come up with to engage artistically is the Pablo Streams Sound and Stories series. Entertainment and illumination emanating from downtown Eau Claire's Pablo Center. Next up is All Creatures Great and Small, a multi-character event coming in a week, March 4th, a presentation of the Chippewa Valley Writers Guild. English professor and author B.J. Hollers heads the Chippewa Valley's Writers Guild. It's not Valleys, it's Valley. So we went to him for some information. That kind of makes sense, doesn't it? Nature-filled, animal-inspired. That sounds like a description of you.
You know, I've been called worse. I would love such a description to be applied to me.
Yeah, I mean, you love dogs, animal-inspired. You like nature. You're out there. You can see where that came from.
Beautiful segue.
That's good. It actually describes the songs and stories we're going to hear in this Pablo Streams special, All Creatures Great and Small. Is there not a PBS show by that name?
And there was a James Herriot book, yes. And
right,
so
right,
it's
right.
Kind of riffing off some of the earlier work, really showcasing animals of all sizes and varieties and what they can teach us.
There you go. Yeah, and now that you mention it, I do have that book in my bookcase. I'm going to have to pull that out and read it again. So you said works. How long has this been in the works?
Pablo is really good at getting stuff on the calendar early. So we kind of pitched these ideas about a year out. And then, you know, a couple months before, I'm like, wait, what was the theme again? And then we kind of got to figure out what we're going to actually do with the theme. But this was an easy one. I mean, folks generally love animals. There's so much to be said about them and our relationship with them. And so I tried to assemble the team of folks to tell these stories, what was really interesting to me is that, gosh, I think three out of the four folks are people I actually got to know by way of my own writing about animals. They were showcased in my book. And It was really fun to have a reunion tour of sorts.
So this Pablo Streams experience is coming up on Thursday, March 4th, and you're the host. You know, I'm going to bet that after nearly a year, people are getting really good at pulling off these virtual things, the first of these virtual everything, which is what we've experienced for the last 11 months. People were a little bit nervous and shy about how to go about doing this. You know, we talk about live radio here, but live media was fun. And I think someday we'll look back on that and say, you know, we were terrible at it at first, but now very good at it.
Well, the Pablo team is just incredible. And of course, they've got like this whole studio they've built, you know, three cameras set up to try to make all the schedules work. We actually are recording this one pre-recorded, but typically we are live. And either way, it's just so fun to watch them kind of work in that switchboard and like unique visuals behind the scenes and all these really cool things that are happening. So collectively, it's just a really wonderful show that's enriching for stories and for music and for the visuals often behind the scene. It's a neat collaboration.
And it's impressive stuff. This part of it's impressive too. And it also represents the potential scope of streaming. You have the times listed for this event in all the American time zones from east to west.
That's what we learned during our Joy to the Word event back in December. I mean, we had probably four or five times as many people as we can typically fit into a room. Part of that might have been that we weren't charging, so it was just a totally free event as this one is. But we had, I think, probably 500 or so folks minimum streaming in from literally all across the U.S. We heard the best feedback from folks in like Arizona and places you would never expect that might be tuning in. So
wow.
It really has in some ways opened us up to whole new avenues and audiences.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to allow you to run down the list of guests and performers. It's quite an all-star cast. I'm familiar with everyone, but you might spend more time on Becca Weitz. She's the one I don't think that I've ever talked with.
Sure, and so we can start there. Becca Weitz is a wonderful, wonderful person. I got to know her when I was working on the dog book. She's an animal welfare expert. I actually did a ride-along with her, and we visited some homes and kind of checked in on some animals. And after that day together, I just really knew she was the kind of person who had some really powerful stories about our relationship with animals. And certainly she's got a great one this time about meeting a new dog at the shelter who was very leery of her and kind of how they bonded in a very unique time in Becca's life. We also have Steve Bechtol, who is an incredible environmentalist, ornithologist. I know him because during the Bird Book, I shadowed him for a couple days. We did some Christmas counts together, and he was really a mentor as I tried to kind of get my birding wings, so to speak. We also have Dr. Kathy Schneider and her CNI dog, Calvin. And Kathy, too, was a big part of the dog book. And so being able to, again, share this story about her experiences with CNI dogs is going to be really moving for our audience. And then finally, last but not least, we have John Hildebrand, nonfiction writer extraordinaire, who's got a great piece about gophers from his book, Mapping the Farm. And so collectively, we just have this wonderful richness of all types of animals, all types of wild, and what they mean for us.
And it's not just going to be people sitting at the camera. There's going to be accompaniment as well. Tell us about that.
We are so blessed to have so many incredible artists and musicians. And so we have some visuals by a guy named Eric Elstrand, who will be helping us out.
Okay.
But we also have musicians, Humbird and The Nunnery, these two incredible musical groups. They have the names of a full group, but they're individual musicians, and they're going to be collaborating to not only provide some background music for some of the pieces, but also then to have individual pieces of music interspersed between the stories. So it's kind of a nice stitching that kind of brings the whole thing together.
And the performance includes sign language interpretation and subtitling, I read.
It does, for the first time, and we are so grateful for the partners and the sponsors who could make that happen and make this a more accessible show for all.
Yeah. So, do you remember the day that you said, hey, we should do, I mean, where did this come from? I mean, you have so many different ideas. This one, did it come from left field? Did it come from right field? Where did it come from?
Well, maybe center field. You know, it was one of those things where I think I probably was starting to think about it when our former dog was getting really up there in age last March, and she had all kinds of medical ailments, and we finally had to let her go right in the middle of COVID late March. It was a terrible day and all the aftermath, of course. But as a result of that, I think it really reminded me of how important these creatures are, these animals are in our lives. I knew there were plenty of local stories that could reflect that, and so, you know, just on the other side of things, now we have this puppy, and now I'm spending all my Tuesday nights at puppy class with this guy. It's really that circle of life mentality that I think we're going to try to capture in the event. And so I think maybe it was a personal story that maybe got us to this theme.
Uh-huh. That's B.J. Hollers. He's an English guy at UW Eau Claire, also started the Chippewa Valley Writers Guild, continues to direct that. We're talking about a special Pablo Streams experience. Pablo Streams, it sounds to me like a Casals album. That's just me. Anyway, it's called All Creatures Great and Small, Sounds and Stories. Starts at 6:30 p.m. That's our time, Central Time, Thursday, March 4th. How do we participate, BJ?
It's super simple. You can easily register to get your free ticket. You can do it at the Pablo website. You can do it at the Chippewa Valley Writers Guild website. We've got all kinds of information on Facebook and Instagram as well. And it's as simple as popping in your email, and they'll send you a link, and you'll be good to go on March 4th.
Cool. Let's, before you go, touch on Midwest Artist Academy. It's, of course, too late to sign up for the first one. February 1st was the deadline there. But what if someone wanted to take a brief tour during this first year, kind of as an introduction? And if that's not possible, we can always look forward to July 17th. There's a culminating evening performance.
There is. And, of course, COVID is leaving so many things in flux in terms of what that will actually look like. But you're absolutely right. Applications rolled in force. We were just overwhelmed and creative. Activity and talent of young folks July 11th through 18th. And on that 17th, that final night, if we can't do an in-person event, we're going to have everything ready to be shared with the community. But we ourselves, all 50 of us and the instructors, will be working together throughout that week, creating some awesome art.
And as I was trying to come up with the best word to use that evening, the 17th will be the result of the experience. And then suddenly, the word result was jumping out at me. Well, what better guy to ask than an English guy?
Oh, boy.
Is there such a thing as a zult?
And then the result.
And then we just result?
Where did I feel like that's an Oxford English Dictionary kind of question, but there's got to be an answer for that one.
I don't lose sleep over it, but I need to know that.
We have an English department meeting tomorrow. We'll make it top of the agenda, and we'll see what we can come up with for you.
Thank you. I don't have the energy to do it myself. BJ, as always, thanks, man.
Thank you so much, Al.
CVWritersGuild.org, website there for you. Coming up, author of the breakout novel Real Life, Brandon Taylor, and a writer just down the road, Michael Perry, and next, A Night of Freedom and Hope. On Spectrum West. Got to get the name in there. Support for WPR comes from Marquardt Toyota, committed to delivering an authentic and enjoyable automotive experience. Marquardt Toyota is located off Highway 53 between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls and at MarquardtToyota.com. Support also comes from Hooper Corporation, supplying custom construction services, including electric power, mechanical, and green technology to commercial, industrial, and utility customers nationwide. Hooper Corporation, a Wisconsin company since 1913. Fierce Freedom is the kind of title that when you hear it, you know whoever is behind it means business. It's a title that encourages us to ask what it's all about. We've done that in the past, and for those unfamiliar, we'll do it again, simply because the subject is vital to societal health. But in the end, we'll provide details about a special evening designed to lend a hand to the commitment. Kat Jacoby handles PR and programs. Matt Canzera gets the technical stuff done. We spoke earlier this week. You know, you go to your website and there is a header that says who we are. I think before we talk about any specifics, we should remind people who you are.
Fierce Freedom has been around. Initially, we got our nonprofit license 2012, but our executive director was educating people about domestic human trafficking since 2007. Yeah, we work to educate and equip individuals, organizations, and communities to the abolishment of human trafficking. So that's our official, you know, statement. And we do this through education by using podcasts, videos. It used to be more in-person presentations. Now it's more virtual. Mm-hmm. And last year, we actually reached around 9,000 people in spite of the pandemic. We also have survivor programming that walks alongside survivors and victims of domestic human trafficking as well.
Okay. So those many years ago when this all started, I'm guessing that there were a bunch of people, especially us in Western Wisconsin, who went, wait a minute, we have a problem with that. And now,
yes.
Do you find people are still surprised that we need, you know, this kind of help and intervention?
Yeah, I think you're right, Al. It's surprising to people still today, because most of us, when we heard about human trafficking for the first time, had some picture in our head of a third world country and somebody chained up somewhere, you know, some of the stories that we'd hear worldwide. But the reality is, it looks different in America, it looks different in Wisconsin, but it very much is a real thing. And I think some of the headlines that have come out even in the last couple of years around Western Wisconsin has opened people's eyes, opened our eyes to the prevalence even of what is going on here. So yes, there still is a need to explain why it's important where we live. But I think, unfortunately, I think people are becoming more aware of the need for what we do. And I think in general, people absolutely want to know how they can help and what they can do.
How did the fishing tournament go? I have to say that that was a first for me.
Yeah, it was great. And that was the first fishing tournament we've ever done. And we partnered with Leadership Eau Claire. And I don't know the final numbers yet, but I know that we raised over $4,000, which was great. And we had almost 100 registrants. You know, reaching different demographics, we're always pushing to do that more because there are people that don't necessarily learn about the work that we do who maybe would fit into that demographic. And the fact is, people are actually sold from ice shacks, and they're sold out of campers and RVs. And right, and I don't know that people have that in their mind as that picture. Like Matt mentioned, they have a sort of Hollywoodized picture. They don't think, oh, that could happen in this area domestically.
One of the tabs, as you can tell, I visited your website. I've also watched some of those videos on the website. One of the tabs is fundraising ideas. You have a big run, too, don't you?
Yes, we have our Justice Run every year, and okay. so that's another way people can get involved. And I always say you don't have to run. You can walk. You can volunteer. Yeah. There's so many ways to participate, and that's a really great way that we have reached the community for several years. I believe it's taking place this year, late July.
It's late July. I don't have the exact date, but I want to just piggyback on what you said, Kat. I've been to this race a number of years, even before I was working with Fierce Freedom, and so far, I have not a single time actually run or even walked the course, but have been able to be a part of it. I don't want to run, but I do want to be a part of it. And that race, the Justice Race, has really grown over the years, and it's a ton of fun. So as of now, we're planning on doing it in person and virtually. Last year, we went all virtual, of course, but time will tell if that will be an in-person event or not this year, and we'll keep everybody updated.
Cool. That's a fundraising idea, and we have news of another fundraiser that's coming up, and we'll get to details on that in a minute, but we're kind of laying a foundation here. Human trafficking in West Wisconsin? Come on. Human trafficking is the fastest-growing criminal enterprise in the world.
Yeah, to really boil that down, it's second only to the drug trade. However, you think about it, you can sell a bag of drugs one time, and you can sell a human being multiple times a day. It's an investment that traffickers are really willing to take. And a lot of this is actually happening online, too. I always want to explain that to families and parents. Your children are not safe behind a screen. And actually, the amount of child sexual abuse material created in 2020, it rose from 2019, the same time period, 90%. Kids were turning online more, you know, with online schooling, and a stranger makes contact and, you know, starts to groom them, maybe sending them cryptocurrency, feeding a need that they have for love, attention. Mm-hmm. They will establish a relationship, probably under false pretenses, acting like they're a younger person. And then that child may send them a nude photo because that's very normalized with kids these days. Huh. But then that person says, okay, well, now I have control over you, because if you don't do X, Y, Z, I will upload this photo to social media, I will send it to your parents, I will ruin your life. That's one of the ways that trafficking can actually look, that, again, I don't know if people wrap their heads around as much, but again, it can take place in a variety of situations. Anywhere that there is demand for it, traffickers will take their product, which is a victim of trafficking that they have groomed. Likely, they will have multiple victims, quote-unquote, working for them wow. at any given time.
Of all the statistics and statements out there, the one that stands out to me is exposing modern-day slavery and exploitation. Here's the last part, in our hometowns. And that's what right. you guys are about.
Absolutely. And people will ask, what can we do to fight human trafficking in our own community? Be aware of who's around us. Be aware of who we can care for, who we can be kind to, who we can be compassionate towards, and develop relationships that will build worth and build value to the people that we're with so that they would never find themselves in that situation. And that's really the best thing that we can do in our hometown, invest in relationships in a way that would help people feel valued and worth something.
That's Matt Kenzera, technology advisor, and Kat Jacoby, public relations and program coordinator for Fierce Freedom Advocate organization in the fight against human trafficking. We're here to talk about a night of freedom and hope that's coming up on Friday, March 5th. I do invite you to go to the website. It's fiercefreedom.org. There are a whole bunch of resources. There are a lot of videos to watch, personal space bubbles and hula hoops and the whole thing, which is which is kind of fun. And
different
lots
approaches.
Of, and there's a list of good books. Before we do the details, tell me about the Fierce Freedom podcast.
That's something for people that want to hear stories of others that are in the fight against trafficking, and they're fighting in their own unique way. That's every week, and that drops every Tuesday. And so people who love podcasts or just want to check it out are welcome to. We've had some really amazing guests, even some national names. We just did a series breaking down how to talk about sex in a very healthy way. We have a variety of topics that we cover. Dr. Celia Williamson, who started the first ever anti-trafficking conference in Ohio. Operation Underground Railroad is another one we had on. And I have my different sphere of influence. How can I be inspired to rise up and fight? What is this person doing? How did they get to where they are today? We want to encourage people to listen and hear these stories.
Okay, who's going to shoot us the details on Night of Freedom and Hope?
Of course, first and foremost, it's going to be as safe as we can possibly make it. So it'll be socially distanced. We can only allow 100 people in the event, but we're also offering a virtual option for people who don't feel comfortable going to a live event. And even if you do a virtual option, we even have baskets of food that you can make at home so you don't miss out on the dinner portion of the event. But basically what we have, it's an opportunity to raise money for Fierce Freedom. It's also an opportunity just to share what's going on in the fight against human trafficking. Live jazz music, great presentation, a great keynote speaker who's our survivor advocate, Amanda Casey. Of course, a wonderful meal, auction items. We're auctioning off a number of experiences this year as opposed to just baskets of items. And again, just a great evening to come together, make a difference, eat some incredible food, and hear about what's going on with the fight against human trafficking all over the country.
Mm-hmm. And the title of the event, twofold. It has a relevance to what we've been going through for the last 11 months. Freedom and hope. I mean, here we are on hopefully the precipice of more freedom and more hope.
Yeah, that would be the dream, right? And I think a lot of us are trying to put our toes in the water of trying to do a few things in a live setting. But at the end of the day, if we all look at our lives, that's what we're all trying to find. And we all find that maybe in different and unique ways. But I think you're absolutely right, Al, that this year is definitely highlighting that even more so. And we can all just hope that there will be more freedom and hope as we come into the new year here.
Hey, keep up the great work, you guys. And we look for a wonderful turnout. Where's the jazz coming from, Kat?
Emily Watkins. I think it's going to be a really cool vibe.
That would be jazz guitar. Can't beat it. It's good for out front and it's good background stuff, too. So yeah. It's going to be a good night. FierceFreedom.org. Everybody go there. Friday, March 5th. Everybody go there, too. Kat and Matt, thanks. Ooh, your rhymes.
Look at that.
Thanks,
Al. Appreciate you having us on.
Coming up on Spectrum West, special guest of the Chippewa Valley Book Festival, Brandon Taylor, shortly. I want to quickly tell you about some auditions coming to the Phipps Center in Hudson. Auditions for Aunt Maggotty's Dark and Stormy Night are going to be this coming Monday and Tuesday from 6 to 8:30 p.m. So that's Monday and Tuesday, March 1st and 2nd. They need students in grades 7 to 9. Details, of course, at thephipps.org. Good luck. You know, when words are your job, you find many ways to make them work for you, even when some of how you make them work for you is on hiatus. That's the dilemma for a guy like Mike Perry. Or Michael, his professional moniker. Longtime friends have a tough time articulating Michael. The author and storyteller and band leader has been hunkering like the rest of us. So you can keep him at home, the place he likes to be and where he gets some of his best work done, but you can't keep him quiet, which is just fine for most of his disciples. So this fundraiser for Tall Pines Conservancy, I realize that place ain't around here, but it is important. Land trusts, conservation, protection of farmland, that's kind of close to your heart stuff.
Well, I've worked with them in the past, and we had a great evening there, and then they got in contact last year for the event. And of course, everything has just been thrown into a tumble.
Sure.
I think I did my last live event February of 2020. Quite literally talking a year.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody's trying to find their way, and I've been doing some live streaming events and things like that. In this case, they're trying to do their annual auction without actually having everybody in the same room.
You're not going to be an auctioneer, are you?
No, there was some talk of that, but there are logistical issues.
I know that's one thing you've always wanted to do.
I would love to be an auctioneer. I just can't talk like one.
No, nor can many of us, no.
One of the very first articles I ever wrote for a magazine was about auctioneers.
Okay.
And how growing up, they were my heroes. They were the celebrities of rural America. Man, they had shtick, they had patter, they had style. You knew them by name, and this auction is being done by Mr. Loughborough. He's funny.
You can still go to auctions and be mesmerized by that rhythm.
Yeah, and go home with things you didn't know you needed.
Yes. Yeah, well,
I've got about a half a pole barn full of that stuff.
See, there's a subliminal thing there. It's like a drug. I need that. And then they sell it to you. So,
yeah, I think if you ever really wanted to write a thesis on human subterranean motivations and ego, auctioneers would be the place to start.
Exactly.
They're so great at convincing you. They let you convince yourself that you really need this thing. Yeah. the main limiting factor on me being the auctioneer was you really need an incredible broadband connection to do anything live. And out here where we live, a friend used this term last year, and I stole it and have been using it ever since. We have what we call the hinternet, which you just cannot rely on it. As a matter of fact, I'm trying to upload something right now that would take about 2 minutes in town, and it's saying 2 hours and 55 minutes.
Yeah.
So what I did is met up with a videographer, and I just sat and talked to a camera, and I shared some stories about growing up on the farm and things that I haven't necessarily talked about and written about before, and they're going to run those along with some photos of little old me on my toy tractor.
Wow, cool.
TNC.
Yeah, I was reading about it. I was going to say this is a night in which, as you've described, people can participate in a virtual auction. And then I was going to say, and Mike, what you're going to pop in like a commercial every once in a while? You know what people do during commercials. And and then I said, or it could be like Mike dropping by and saying, hey, I have some slides from last summer's vacation. I got the projector in the car.
I think you pretty much hit on it there with the second part, yeah. It was one of those deals where over the years I've learned sometimes you just got to trust folks. So the videographer came up here and we just sat in a room. It was one of those super below zero days, and so his equipment wouldn't work outside. So we set up a shoot, and I ran my yapper, and then he's editing them into several different bite-sized pieces, yeah. And then, you asked me if this is close to my heart, and the thing about the Tall Pines Conservancy, the group that's doing this, one of the things I appreciate about them is that obviously I appreciate the fundamental thing they're doing, which is preserving waterways, they're preserving family farms, and even the structures on those farms. And I appreciate that because that's what I come from. Mm-hmm. But I also appreciate it because there are so many of us who come from that background who simply don't have the resources to do it. You know, the family farm in Wisconsin has been struggling for years, but lately it's just been devastating. And so I appreciate those who have the means and the wherewithal and the time and the determination to preserve at least a taste of this stuff so that we know what we came from and possibly what we'll, you know, we can draw on that also if we ever move back in that direction.
Yep, and this program airs on Thursday, so I should let people know that the virtual evening to benefit Tall Pines Conservancy is tonight at 6:30. The website is tallpinesconservancy.org. And again, this is in southern Wisconsin, but the reach of this kind of stuff is tremendous. It affects us all over. And you know what? When you register to be part of this, man, you can tell this is Wisconsin because you get some cheese and some beef sticks with it.
When you register and pay your registration fee, they take good care of you from the get-go, whether you get anything at the auction or not.
Cheese and beef sticks. Michael Perry with us. You recognize the voice. What else you been up to? I've asked most people on this show in the last 11 months, people who deal in art or words or music, if their art has been influenced by and does it currently reflect our predicament, like original poems and songs, etc. How about you? Has the hunkering been happy for the most part?
I don't think it's all been happy, no. I mean, I have nothing but gratitude and so much to be grateful for. I always feel I have to preface that. The gratitude kicks in that I've been doing this long enough that I had other side projects that I could bring to the fore. One of the things is I reverted back to what got you and I to meet for the very first time. I self-published 3 books. And
cool.
The first time I met Al Ross, I had self-published a book, and he invited me on his radio show to talk about it.
Long time ago.
So what I did this year is I have a couple of books under contract, and I'm working on those. But then I also had a couple of books that they're just these collections of short pieces, and it's just worked out better to go the self-publishing route and release those. I found it invigorating. It was back to the old days of just hustling your own stuff, and I got them printed and got them out there. And then as far as it affecting my art, I write a weekly column, and so a lot of what we've gone through has been reflected in that. But for the most part, I have to keep working on what I was working on before. But I have one project. I've written a novella, I guess you'd call it, because it's about 30,000 words long, and it's the darkest thing I've ever written, and I'm nervous to let it out because it is not a happy book. It's all metaphorical and allegorical, but it's definitely a reflection of the last year. And so we'll see if that thing ever sees the light of day or not. So the answer is what we've been facing here has affected my art. It's also affected our little family business, and then we've had to make some adjustments. But man, I want to end in gratitude. I'm just lucky to be in there swinging.
here's the deal. Creative people have no excuse for not getting stuff done. I mean, it's not like there have been a lot of distractions like, oh, man, I meant to finish that, but I was called away to a big hugging convention, you know?
Right.
You can't.
Yeah, I haven't had to load up the van.
So you have phone messages or email or something that's been keeping people in touch, too, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I started it's on a platform called Substack, and I call it Michael Perry's Voicemail. It's like a mini podcast. I try to keep them between 6 and 8 minutes long, but each week, and it's not on a set schedule, although it usually comes out on Tuesday. I just get up in the morning, I come out to my little room over the garage, and I look out the window, and I report on what I see out that window, and then I choose an excerpt from one of my books in the past, and I read it, and then I do what I call a roughneck reflection, maybe how things have changed since I wrote that piece, or what it evoked, and you sign up for it. It's a subscription-based thing. You can subscribe per month, per year. There's also a free option. We send out a few, usually one a month, that you can sample whether you have a paid subscription or not. It's been fun to do. It surprised us.
I was thinking over the weekend that we've been virtual for so long that we might not remember how to be actual.
Yeah, it's interesting. The little reflexes that you've developed. The little family and I gathered up the other night and watched a Cheers rerun of all things. And you know, they do the scene where everybody comes into the bar and they're sitting down, and you actually, for a moment, you have this thing where you're like, you folks got to get your masks on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it has affected some of our thinking, and certainly with kids and kids in school, middle school is a tough enough dynamic, let alone in times like this when some kids aren't seeing their friends as much and there's turmoil about how we're dealing with things or not dealing with things.
True.
And, so I think the kids have been affected as well.
Well, it's been fun yapping with you, as you like to say. But thanks.
All right.
Thanks, man. Yeah. And keep in touch.
Thanks.
Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to have you along. Support for WPR comes from Charter Bank, dedicated to investing in partnerships and offering Charter Bank business services with small business loans, treasury management services, and a variety of checking accounts. Details are at charterbank.bank. Support also comes from UW Health, with colon cancer specialists offering second opinions focused on diagnosis and treatment. Fight smarter. More information is at uwhealth.org/colon. The Chippewa Valley Book Festival has a reputation for being hands-on and face-to-face, except when the hands-on is sanitizer and the face is wearing a mask. But a big part of its reputation is the opportunity to rub elbows, which is still allowed, with some of the brightest stars in our literary sky. I use that metaphor to describe author Britt Bennett, with whom we spoke and you spoke a couple weeks ago, and it's equally descriptive of Brandon Taylor, another young writer with a breakaway novel on his hands. Real Life, the name of the novel, fits the description of autofiction, imagined characters acting out a story all too familiar to the writer. An introverted African-American from Alabama, at odds with a Midwestern college town in which he's pursuing a science degree, the main character, Wallace, endures confrontations with colleagues and watches his defenses fracture while wondering if it's ever really possible to overcome private wounds and buried histories, and at what cost. And I've been told you'll never forget the dinner party in the book. So that's a setup to a conversation I enjoyed on Monday with Brandon Taylor, the author of and behind Real Life, and he's appearing March 12th as part of this year's Book Festival. Brandon, allow me to set up our media relationship by saying that I have not read your book, Real Life, and if that feels like an affront because I haven't sampled your product, I should apologize, but so as not to steal thunder from your virtual appearance with fans of the Chippewa Valley Book Festival, I want to simply introduce the man and begin by saying welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Raised in Alabama, attended Auburn University for undergraduate studies, then joined a graduate biochemistry program at UW-Madison, got a degree, and in 2016 began a career in creative writing. Brandon, is that a 90-degree or a 180-degree turn, do you think?
I mean, in some ways, it's neither. It's just moving completely to a different plane of existence. It feels like, I mean, it was quite the transition, a lot of changes.
Yeah. I know other writers who have degrees unrelated to writing or literature, and they say that it's to fall back on if necessary. Is that in the back of your head?
No. I was going to be a scientist. I wanted to be a scientist from the time I was very young, mm-hmm. like 4 or 5. And so I pursued science as like the thing that I was going to do. And writing was the thing that more took me by surprise as like a career. But once I left science, you know, like I was like, okay, I'm leaving science for real. Like I it's too painful to imagine like going back to it at any one point because it was such a fraught choice to leave it. So mm-hmm. No, it's not really a fallback.
But writing doesn't appear to creep up on people. Were you writing as you were also being trained to be a scientist?
Yeah, I mean, I had always written little stories to amuse myself as a young person. Okay. And when I was working in the lab, I was writing primarily for myself. I didn't know that like writer was a job. I didn't know how one would even go about building a career as a writer. So like it wasn't anything that I thought I was going to do professionally. It was something that I was doing as like a creative outlet more than anything else. And then the professional side is more what snuck up on me, I'll say.
Yeah. It might appear as filler for me to bring this up, and that is your affiliation with Electric Literature and LitHub. And let's mention that you're a senior editor and contributor to those, respectively. After getting to know them a bit, I'd like our audience to know them, too, because if in our audience you like literature and reading, these are smorgasbords that you're going to want to fatten up on.
Absolutely. Electric Literature, you know, it's a website and we have content, essays and the like every day. And weekly, there are two literary magazines at Electric Lit, Recommended Reading and The Commuter, where we publish free online quite substantial pieces of fiction and original fiction and excerpts from some of, you know, the literary world's like leading authors. It's also a place where you can like sample, you know, the new upcoming books from writers that you might love or want to get to know. So it's a fantastic place to get to know an author, I'll say. And LitHub has like some of the best essays and writing on literature and life and what it means to be an artist out there. They're both great sites. Yeah. For anyone who's interested even a little bit in writing or in literature.
Like I said, smorgasbords. Mm-hmm. You won't leave those places hungry, will you?
No.
I read that you consider yourself a short story writer, although that's probably evolving as we speak. I also read about the speed with which you wrote Real Life, your breakout novel, and yet I also read about it sitting in a drawer for stretches, the first draft anyway. What happened when the first draft emerged from the drawer? Did you at all feel differently about each other, the book and you? Or and also, was Wallace, the main character, still the same guy when he came out of the drawer?
That's a great question. I'll say that when I finished the first draft of the book, I separated from my literary agent, and I had lost a lot of faith in the project, and I wasn't sure that it was a good book, and so I put it in a drawer. You know, maybe like 5 or 6 months went by, something like that, and I got a new agent. I was working on stories, and I told the agent I had a novel, but that it was bad and that I wouldn't show it to her. And she said, okay, I don't want to read a bad novel, and if you say it's bad, it must be bad. But then I sort of overcooked my stories a little bit, and she got worried about what book we were going to sell. So she went back to the novel draft that I had sent her and told her not to read. And she read it and really loved it. And so she was really instrumental in encouraging me to take it out of the drawer and really look at it again. And when I took it out of the drawer, I was still pretty dubious on it. I was like, you know, I just don't know if this is a good book. Like, I'm not sure if this is the book that I want to put into the world. It feels to me like no one will care about these characters. Who cares about some scientists in the Midwest? Like, nobody who wants to read that. But no, she really believed in the book, and she really thought that it should be published. And so we went out on submission with it. And even after I sold the book, I was still very dubious. I was just like, are you sure people are going to want to read this? This feels like a thing maybe 5 people would want to read. And what my friends told me was like, well, Brandon, if 5 people read your book, that's fantastic. You know, like you don't publish the book for like millions and millions of people to read. Like, you publish the book because you want those five people to read it. You write it for the people who need it. And
sure. Mm-hmm.
They sort of got me thinking more about that and the life of the book and how I should focus, you know, less on being a mega bestseller, like broad appeal, and focus on who I'd written the book for. And so, you know, my friends were really instrumental in getting me to come around to it. But I don't think that I really believed that the book was a good book until like maybe a month before it published, after all the when the final text was set, I was finally at peace with it. I think, yeah, I was quite at peace with it by the time it published.
That's quite a process. Did you read it over and over and over and you just didn't see the worth for a while, but then you said, there's a lot of people that like this. Maybe I should like this.
Well, I'm a very intense reviser, and so I did read the book quite a lot. I would print in hard copy the whole book out and then mark it up and make changes, and then I would retype it word by word into a new Word document, and then I would print it out and do it over again. I did that like five or six times, really living in the text of the book again. And I enjoyed that work of it. I enjoyed that part of it, but I still just like couldn't understand. I just felt people would think that it was a very simple book, or that it was a bad book, or that it wasn't well constructed or well made. And I had all these like intense doubts about it. I made my peace with the book by the time it published, but it was really encountering readers who told me that they saw themselves in the book, and that they saw their experiences reflected in the story. They were the ones who helped me come around to it. And I don't know, it started to feel ungenerous of me to be like, oh, but it sucks. You know, it felt like spitting in the face of all the great kindness and generosity with which readers had approached the book. It was more that I was afraid of saying that I loved this book and being afraid that people would think that it was bad. Classic doubt problem, classic imposter syndrome in some ways.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, certainly the people who read the book and saw something of themselves reflected in it, they were, you know, they helped me sort of come to a place of like greater acceptance and appreciation for the book.
I'm glad I asked that question, because now for sure I'm going to read the book. I have to. I have to now, man. We're talking with Brandon Taylor. He is the author of Real Life, the novel, been described as a gut punch of a novel, if I remember my reading correctly. He is a guest of the Chippewa Valley Book Festival coming up Friday evening, March 12th. It's a virtual affair, and we'll tell you all about how to participate when we're done yakking with Brandon here, which is extremely delightful. Two words, Brandon, that I've run into in the last few months are microaggression and empathy. I don't think there's anything micro in a definition of microaggression, so we're not going to get into that. And interestingly, it might take empathy to understand anyway. So let's focus on empathy. The ability to emotionally understand what other people feel, see things from their point of view, and imagine yourself in their place. Essentially, it is putting yourself in someone else's position and feeling what they must be feeling. Okay, we all knew that. Call me a cynic, but I oftentimes don't see how that's possible. Let's consider black and gay, and if I'm white and straight, attempted empathy, maybe, realizing that it could open some doors, maybe, but if organic, non-GMO empathy were possible, we'd be further along, don't you think?
Oh, maybe so. I mean, I think that we get caught up in the specificity of empathy in some ways that we kind of lose sight of the really basic truth of it, which is to understand any person, no matter what they might have in common with you or not have in common with you, requires empathy. You know, like understanding our parents or our siblings or our cousins or aunts or the person just down at the grocery store, all of that requires empathy in some ways. Like all of it is emotional work. Like in my family, like I come from a family of very difficult people, and you know, it was quite a difficult way to grow up. And people assume like, oh, but it's your family, like you all understand each other. But like, no, like understand, to come to an understanding of like my parents and my brother and my cousins and that whole situation required a lot of work for me. It required a lot of empathy.
Okay.
And so I think that empathy is I think that empathy seems really complicated and really hard, and we get caught up on like the things that separate us and the obvious signifiers of difference. But to me, it requires as much empathy to understand other Black queer people as it takes to understand like straight cis white men. For me as a person, I have to work really, really hard at understanding and showing compassion and understanding of other people, and realizing that like empathy doesn't mean condoning, it doesn't mean accepting behaviors that I may not agree with, but it means understanding that that person is a complicated, rich human being with history, with love, with things they hate, etc., and like honoring that complexity of their humanness. So, yeah, I think that empathy is the same regardless of the other person on the other side that you're trying to empathize with, you know?
So probably it's the understanding part of that long definition I read more than the ability to put yourself in someone else's position. Understanding and accepting, I suppose, is the better part of it. And earlier this month, which of course is Black History Month, I revisited the book Black Like Me because it came out in my formative years. And I thought to myself, you know, that's the kind of empathy I can imagine. I called it embedded empathy. Yeah, so there you go. I mean, how do you not get empathy when you do what that guy did? So, yeah, I'm hoping that we're capable of getting there, and there is this lofty place. And I'm afraid that maybe there will always be your experience and my experience, and maybe we don't meet. But of course, I did label myself as the cynic when I went into that whole thing. So I'm not that way all the time. We're close to wrapping up here, but here's a two-part inquiry for you. Was there a result for you, emotional or transformational or therapeutic, to writing real life, or was it just pride and satisfaction at having done the work and done it well?
Well, you know, I mean, I grew up on a farm. I grew up doing chores. My entire family is farmers. So the idea of like doing the work and doing it well is like deeply embedded in my in my personality and my selfhood. I have a real sort of, I think, almost puritanical work ethic in that way. And so, yeah, the getting the work done and feeling like I had done the best I could was satisfactory to me. And I will say that finishing the book, there was an emotional component to that, but it didn't come until much later. It didn't come until I had sort of, you know, until I had finished the book and put it into the world, and other people started to say, like, I didn't know it was this bad for anyone else. I didn't know that working in academia and in science was this fraught and complicated for other people. I thought I was the only one, et cetera. And that's when I realized that in some way I had written the book in order to change my life. And I'd written the book as a way of talking back to dynamics and structures and systems that tried to silence me, and that I felt in some way like I had finally come out of the other side of it. The emotion definitely hit me at a real delay, but when it did, I was like, oh, that's why I wrote this book.
We talked last week. There's a documentary out about women in science and how, you know, they've been held back and bias against women. And I wish I could remember the name of it, but that's interesting, too. And your wonderful answer of the first part of my two-part inquiry took care of the second part, because I was going to ask about consequence and feedback and responses that you were hearing from people. So way to go. You killed two birds with that one stone. You're working on another novel. I asked Britt Bennett a couple weeks ago about that process, knowing there may now be expectations of someone having had a successful first one. Staying on a mountaintop can be harder than getting there. Is that something you think about?
Yeah, I'm working on my second book. It's a collection of short stories. It was a strange experience because I was starting to work on revisions for that book when I got the news about Real Life being a Booker long list. And suddenly there was all of this intense scrutiny on me, and I felt in some ways, I could feel that attention kind of mutating the work in ways that I found really uncomfortable and unpleasant. And so I had to really work really hard at like creating some distance for the new work to breathe. And I think that that's going to be something that I contend with for the rest of my life. Not that it's like some great undue burden to have had success or for people to have loved your work, but once you've had some measure of success, it becomes even more imperative to make it about the work and to create distance for your new work so that it can breathe and flourish and mm-hmm. so that you can go to those like messy, complicated places you have to go to in order to get to good work, you know? It can feel really hard to let yourself be a mess on the page.
Sure.
And the way that you gotta be in order to get to the good stuff. So yeah, I mean, it's something that I'm aware of and something that I'm now working hard at to create space and comfort for myself to be messy in order to do hopefully better writing than I did in my first book.
Yeah, and hopefully you have more faith in your abilities now. You probably do. And by all means, be sure, even if it's just for a couple days, stick this new book in that lucky drawer, will you?
I will. That's some great advice. Thank you.
I think you should get a label maker and just put lucky drawer on the front, and everything you write should go in there. It's like an oven, you know.
Huh? Like an incubator. Yeah, no, I love that. Oh, that's so brilliant. I'm going to do that.
I truly hope we can talk again, and given the on-ramp of your traveling, I do believe that will happen. All the best. Thanks for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much. Have a great week.
Brandon Taylor, the novel is Real Life. Great book, great guy, great future. Great opportunity to connect. Friday evening, March 12th, simply head to cvbookfest.org and registration is just a couple of clicks away. I want to be sure to remind you that Feed My People Food Bank, their largest annual fundraiser, Empty Bowls, is shifting to a week-long bowl drive-through event, and that is next week. To participate and support local families facing food insecurity, you can purchase a ticket online, then come to Feed My People during Empty Bowls Week, which is next week, as we said. Pick up your one-of-a-kind bowl gift bag without ever leaving your vehicle. They also have a silent auction going on right now through the 6th of March. FMPfoodbank.org is their website. Hey, thanks to Kate and Dean and to you. I invite you to visit WPR.org to find Spectrum West archived there. Whenever necessary, get out there, wear a mask, keep your eyes on the road, and be sure to look for ways to make a positive difference. I'm Al Ross. See you next week.